On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
For American History Month, we're delighted to welcome Jack D. Warren Jr., the author of Freedom, the Enduring Importance of the American Revolution. It's from Lyons Press, that's L-Y-O-N-S Press. And the book is a big, beautiful, you might call it a coffee table book. It's that size, with full-color maps and lots of full-color pages of Revolutionary War figures. And it's just loaded with information, but it's also loaded with insight. And that's what really, really interested me and why I enjoyed reading it so much and why I think that you guys are going to enjoy hearing Jack talking to us. He's a native of D.C. His work focuses on the enduring achievements in the American Revolution. Served on the faculty of the University of Virginia, where he was an editor of the papers of George Washington. He was the executive director of the Society of the Cincinnati and founding director of the American Revolution Institute. His books include The Presidency of George Washington and America's First Veterans, and of course his newest book, Freedom. So Jack, thank you very much for joining us today on the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you for having me. This is fun.
The thing that really struck me when reading the book is not just that there's a lot of information in it, and there certainly is that, and not that there isn't information that I hadn't read anywhere else. For example, how much debt Great Britain went into fighting what we call the French and Indian War. Even more significantly, going into the whys and wheres. How is it that Americans started thinking of themselves in those terms rather than as British citizens? What caused a group of people to think at this particular point in time, hey, we don't need kings anymore. Let's just have a government that's by the people. We've had these things so long now that we take them for granted, but these were radical revolutionary ideas at the time.
Oh, they absolutely were. And that's one of the things I'm trying to convey here is the sense of wonder and amazement that I think all Americans should have with our revolution. Before the revolution, colonial Americans, and indeed everybody everywhere in the world, were subjects of some kind of monarch, a king, a prince, a czar, call them by whatever name you wanted, almost all of them claiming to rule by some kind of divine right, by hereditary privilege, and that was the norm in the world. And people everywhere were, none of them were free, not in the way we have come to understand freedom. That freedom is really a legacy of the American Revolution. And that's what I was trying to convey here, is that sense of amazement at the accomplishment of our revolution, which is the basis of all of our substance.
Right. This war was unique in a century that had Great Britain was involved in 8 major wars in the 18th century. But this is the one that was the most significant to them and that had the longest reaching effects. This was a different kind of war than had ever happened before because of what you just said. These are people that say, we're not going to be subjects anymore. And the people whose subjects he still considered them to be, King George III said, we'll just see about that. And on that linchpin, everything changed for the world. And people didn't realize that at the time, or at least not everybody did, but this became a world history-changing event.
It did, and it not simply because it was a war of great consequence, but because it was a movement of principle of remarkable importance. When Americans came to declare their independence, they didn't just say, you know, we are now our own sovereign nation, we owe no dependence on you, our king. People have done that, revolutions against colonial domination, over and over again, the last 200 years, although the United States was the first nation created in modern times in a revolution against colonial authority. But it was a revolution of principle. I mean, and the Declaration of Independence tells us that in words that we have heard 1,000 times, but that whose importance we should never forget. The Declaration doesn't just say we're independent of you. It says what the basic rights of ordinary people are. Right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, a remarkable claim.
Yes.
That those truths were self-evident. They weren't evident to anybody in the world in the 18th century. It was a century of darkness and tyranny and oppression, really, by our standards, that all men are created equal and they're endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, what a remarkable declaration of national independence, where you talk about the rights of individuals, not national identity, not the state, but people, ordinary people. It's a world-shaking moment.
I think back on that idea, really, of when did we start thinking of ourselves as separate from Britain? And to a certain extent, was it because, in a way, we always were. Britain kind of loosely held us. They weren't really repressive on us until about a decade before the Revolution. But had Americans always thought of themselves as kind of separate, or was that something that came about as a result of being treated badly when we fought alongside them during the what we call the French and Indian War?
You know, that is one of, I think, the great and central questions of early American history. How and when did Americans develop a sense of separate identity from Britain? Of course, by the eve of the American Revolution, say by the 1775, what became the United States was home to all kinds of people who weren't necessarily from Britain. We had a lot of German immigrants. Of course, we had a lot of forced African immigrants who were becoming African American in a meaningful sense. We had people from all parts of Western Europe who didn't identify as closely as, I mean, they were used to subordination to a king, but they didn't identify themselves closely as British or English. And of course, there were lots of Scots, and they had a troubled relationship with the English.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, we were a mix of people, an amazingly diverse place, even on the eve of the Revolution. Americans had always been proud of being part of the British Empire, even though many of them, think of the Puritans of New England and so forth, had fled England to worship as they wished, to get away from at least the oppression of the established church in England. You know, they thought of themselves as British up until the end of the French and Indian War, but Britain began to tighten its hand. It, as you suggested, they had never really regulated the colonies very closely. And for, you know, over 100 years, the colonies had developed more or less on their own. You know, the British had collected some taxes, but not much, and most of it on trade. But for the most part, the British had benefited from trade with their colonies, and the colonies were satisfied with that. But in the 1760s, by which time, you know, the colonies were growing in demographically and in economic importance to the British Empire, the British said, hey, we need to regulate this better. We need to derive more revenue from our colonies. And that's what led the colonists to say, wait a minute, we're used to not being regulated. We have, in fact, been for a long time very, very free people. And you're trying to take away the freedoms we've enjoyed, which forced Americans to start thinking about what freedom meant.
There were a couple of people that were enormously significant in this time era. I guess the towering figure of the American Revolution and of the decades that followed was George Washington. And of course, you've written a whole book about him. And his presidency, he had to establish a lot of precedents because there weren't really a lot of things in the Constitution that said exactly much more about the president than we had to have one, and they were in charge of the military. So we could talk for a half an hour about just George Washington. But I would like to mention, and Thomas Jefferson is duly regarded for his authorship of the Declaration of Independence, but there's another guy, and I was glad to see that you brought this out in the book, Freedom, and that is John Adams, because he's not as flamboyant as Jefferson was, and he's not as tall and commanding as Washington was, but if it hadn't been for John Adams, the Revolution, and a successful revolution, would not have been possible, it seems.
That's true. The book and my interpretation of the American Revolution rests heavily on three great characters, and they are Washington, who is the leader throughout. And that's an extraordinary thing. Washington himself is a man of unimpeachable character. I spent much of my life studying Washington, and I can say without hesitation that he's one of the few people that I've studied for many, many years who always grows in my estimation as I study him. Washington was an extremely wise politician, statesman, we say when we don't want to use the word politician, a fine military leader, even though he wasn't a victorious general in the Napoleonic sense. He lost many more battles than he won, but he won the war.
Yeah.
He knew how to keep his army going, and it wasn't so much winning on the battlefield as mattered as winning the war, keeping the army intact, resisting the British until the British gave up in exhaustion, which is what they did. Jefferson is a great thinker and important, but actually the second character in my book is Adams, without question. Adams is the great American philosopher. He's the philosopher of America's Republican constitutions, and far more important in this regard than Jefferson, far more. More erudite, I think, than Jefferson, if I had to be candid and find a place to disagree with you. Jefferson was a brilliant person, a cosmopolitan in his interests, broad thinker, interested in all branches of science and art. But Adams was among the leaders of that generation, the most profound in his understanding of political philosophy. And he designed the basic principles of American constitutionalism, which were, you know, adopted in the first state constitutions during the war, which almost all bear his imprint in one way or another, except the failed one of Pennsylvania, which only had one house in the legislature and was a mess and had to be replaced ultimately with one on a John Adams-type design later. Adams is really, in many ways, the father of the American Constitution, the federal Constitution, and that's ironic because we credit that to Madison, and Madison is very important. Adams was in Europe when the Constitutional Convention met in 1787. He was serving as an ambassador there, and so didn't get to participate in the Federal Convention of 1787. But if he had, he would have been the giant in that pot body. He had recently written a book called The Defense of the Constitutions of the United States, and which had been published in Europe and republished in America and read by everyone who was, you know, really intellectually engaged with the process of constitution making. He was the great intellectual of the era, and I want the readers to understand and appreciate that. No, he wasn't as, you know, he didn't dance well, and he didn't look good on a horse. Washington was extraordinarily athletic and handsome. I know that may be hard for some listeners who are used to looking at paintings of Washington done in the 1790s when he was quite old. Mm-hmm. By the standards of that day, he was in his 60s and his health was starting to go downhill. But Washington during the Revolution, he took over the Continental Army at 42, very athletic, great rider, horseback rider. Jefferson said the greatest rider of his age. You know, it was young men wanted to ride with Washington. Old men wanted to listen to his ideas. He was a remarkable leader. But Adams was the thinker of that day, and really is to be considered first among the constitutional thinkers. The third great character, if you will, I think, in our revolutionary is the ordinary American person. We talk about the founding fathers, and by the way, I avoid using that phrase in my book,
right?
Because I don't think it's apt. The American Revolution embodied the aspirations of hundreds and thousands of ordinary Americans, and it wouldn't have happened without all of those people who had a will to be free in different ways. They all wanted to accomplish something, and you have to have that. You know, no matter, you may have a generation of great leaders, and we did. We had Washington and Jefferson and Adams and Madison and Patrick Henry and on. I mean, a galaxy of leaders unlike any we will have ever had or will ever see again. But ordinary people wanted to be free. Without that aspiration, without those ordinary people, all those famous leaders would have just been, you know, guys out by themselves without anybody following them. The American people are really at the center of my story.
John Adams, to me, is a great character, a great person. In the musical 1776, I love it that he is always self-deprecating, but he's smart enough to find people and use them and their strengths to get accomplished what he wants, which is independence. The interesting thing about Washington to me, as you mentioned earlier, is that he didn't really have to win a lot of battles. He just had to keep escaping the British Army in a war of attrition, and mostly a war of patience. But he did have a few victories that were particularly significant, and one of them was at Trenton and the other at Princeton. Would you speak to those two battles?
Oh, you're right. Washington. There are moments when Washington is victorious on the battlefield, and they are epic moments in our history. I mean, if there's a great turning point of the war, a moment of the war, if I could go back in time to watch.
Yes.
I would want to watch. is the victory at Princeton in particular. But, you know, yeah, what had happened was, and let me frame it for the listeners to understand, Britain decided they were going to put down the American rebellion by force. And so in 1776, they sent the largest army any European power had ever sent overseas for any purpose to America. They sent 36,000 troops, a mixture of British troops and Hessian mercenaries, and an enormous fleet. They sent it to America to knock the rebellion out in one fell swoop. And they fought a campaign against Washington's army around New York City, took Washington's army and beat Washington repeatedly. And that culminated in the fall of Fort Washington, which is on Upper Manhattan, loss of like 3,000 Americans and most of Washington's artillery. And Washington had to retreat all the way across New Jersey into Pennsylvania. And this is late November and into December of 1776. And it looked at that moment for all the world like the revolution was ending. You know, people who, you know, the British Army came close to them. They went and they signed loyalty oaths and promised to be loyal to the king henceforth. It looked for all the world like the thing was over. And Washington sort of had taken shelter behind the Delaware River and deliberately destroyed all the boats across the river. So with the British approach, they couldn't cross the river and take Philadelphia, attack his army, and finish the war. But it's at that moment that Washington decides that the way that he can survive is to attack and win. The British had posted the Hessian garrison at Trenton along the Delaware, and the British had stopped. This is an important, and I tell this part of the story. General Howe, who was in command of the British Army, had stopped pursuing Washington as he fled across New Jersey, and General Cornwallis, who was really Howe's most aggressive subordinate, wanted to chase Washington down before he got across the Delaware River and destroy the American army. And Howe said, no, don't do that. I'm going to need somebody to surrender to me. you know, and that's true. You think about wars, you have to make sure that you don't defeat the enemy so totally that there isn't anybody to help bring the war to an end. And so Howe, Washington's army is going to dissolve. It's not a problem. We don't need to fight one more battle against the ragtag bit that he has left. This thing is going to come to a negotiated end very quickly. Washington didn't accept that. He crossed the river, attacked the Hessians at Trenton, it surprised them on Christmas in 1776, won a great victory over a relatively small number of Hessians. Of course, the British were, you know, response was, well, that was the Hessians. You know, those are paid soldiers. They didn't defeat the regular British army. But a couple of days later, Washington recrossed the Delaware River into New Jersey. And at that point, the British thought, we've got him. Washington had gone back to Trenton. The British had confronted him at Trenton. And during the night, Washington decided he could have crossed back over the Delaware, but that was dangerous. He decided to slip sideways, slip off to the north by the right flank, and get behind the British army, attack their outpost at Princeton. And at the beginning of the Battle of Princeton, the British had their way. You know, the British, there was a British unit there that attacked Washington's army, the head of Washington's army, drove it in, killed General Hugh Mercer, who was one of Washington's friends in the army. And it looked for all the world like Washington's army was going to dissolve right there on that frozen battlefield. This was January the 2nd, 1777. And then Washington calmly reorganized the troops that had been, you know, dispirited, reorganized them, and led them personally in a charge against the British. People said who watched it said they had to hold their breath, thinking, you know, all the time Washington was going to be shot down in battle. But Washington drove the British and had the pleasure for the first time in battle of seeing the British, the backs of British soldiers turn and run. And it must have been, you know, for Washington, you know, one of the great moments of his life. And so it's a, you know, it's an extraordinary moment, and it's an epic story. I mean, men, ordinary men, people who, just common laborers and seamen and brewers and ordinary, you know, working men who made up that army. You know, we know something about who they were, and, you know, we're fighting, you know, a well-trained British army on a frozen field in January in desperate cold, and won. And it was an extraordinary moment, an epic moment, something that we can all take pride in, celebrate as a nation, and we should. It's a great story, and it involves all kinds of people. And I try to integrate that into the story of the revolution, you know, the story of ordinary black American soldiers who served in the revolution, an enormous number, particularly in the latter stages of the war, you know, who are fighting many cases to earn their freedom. If they were enslaved, some were offered the prospect of freedom for their service, and so they signed up. And you know, there are some whose stories we know pretty well, and they say, you know, they appreciate the irony of fighting for freedom while they are enslaved, but they too have an aspiration to be free, and many of them fulfill that in this desperate war. It's a great epic story.
Yes, it does. Also remind me that we need to explain to modern listeners that fighting during the dead of winter was completely crazy. That generally speaking, every other year of the war, they went into winter camping in October or so and didn't come out until May. So for them to fight when no decent people would be fighting is the way the British looked at it. What do you mean attacking us now? You're supposed to be in
winter quarters.
In winter quarters. What are you doing? You know,
as modern life continues and our world becomes much more sophisticated, it becomes more and more and more difficult for Americans to appreciate the circumstances under which people lived. In the 18th century. An 18th century army marched on a road that looked like, you know, if the listener can imagine, the most pathetic dirt road they've ever seen. That would be the best road in America in 1775.
Yeah.
I mean, the roads over which Washington marched to the battles at Trenton and Princeton really were just, you know, they were just dirt paths.
Yeah.
Probably about 8 feet wide. In winter, of course, if it's wet, they're churned up in mud, and you're trying to haul artillery, you know, heavy guns, which sink, you know, all the way up to the axles in the mud. That's why armies don't move in the wintertime. And the British, you know, of course, were appalled that Americans engaging, trying to campaign in the winter, which is part of the great story of Trenton and Princeton as well.
Indeed. Well, and we could spend another half hour talking about Knox and his amazing way of moving all those cannon across frozen wilderness from Fort Ticonderoga to where they'd be useful by Washington. He's another great character, and I don't want to get sidetracked because I know we're running short on time, and I do want to talk about the last couple chapters about the significance of the Constitution. But John Knox, he's one of my heroes too.
He is, and a great character, and again, one of the problems I alluded to earlier, Henry Knox, we picture him, if we can picture him at all, as this sort of big, fat, old man with gray hair. He was in his 20s when he was a brigadier general, and when he was doing all the, you know, wonderful things he did to keep the artillery going, organize it during the Revolutionary War. He was a young man, and this was a young man's war.
Yeah, let's take a moment to talk about, because again, these are things, with these documents we've had so long, it's easy for us to take them for granted, but these were incredibly influential, incredibly important things that happened in this span of 15 years or so. The Constitution comes up because the Articles of Confederation is just that, a confederacy with no way of raising tax money other than begging the states to send some. And that didn't work so well. And so they get together to change things, knowing that what they're going to have to do is just a complete rewrite, and that's what they do.
They do, and they go farther than anyone had ever gone. It's the first great national constitution, first written constitution to govern a large nation, a large republic in the history of the modern world. There's a stake that has been sort of foisted on us over the last 100 years, that there's something undemocratic about the U.S. Constitution, that it was a kind of, sometimes the phrase uses, a counter-revolutionary document, that the founding fathers, as the writer will say, were anxious about the excesses of democracy. And so the Constitution is framed in such a way to curtail democracy in America, we've gone way too far in that argument. The Constitution, the federal Constitution, is in fact a remarkably democratic instrument, particularly by the standards of the 18th century, where there were no democratic republics of any consequence in the world. It's the first frame of government ever adopted anywhere in the world in which legislative authority, which is to be the supreme authority, the authority of Congress, is predicated on a national census. See, we think the census is such a common thing to us now. You know, yes, every 10 years we enumerate everybody in the country. We're so used to it that we forget its significance. The framers of the Constitution said, you know, we're going to apportion representation by population so that we can have a truly democratic and representative legislature, which means we're going to count everybody every 10 years, and we're going to base representation on that. Nobody had ever done that before. It was such an extraordinary thing. All the legislatures, like the British Parliament, for example, that had existed for hundreds of years, were completely undemocratic.
Right.
I mean, there were places in Britain that weren't represented at all, and there was no sense of proportional representation in Parliament. I mean, we invented that idea, and it's now so common. Every legislature in the world is based on some form of, that's not true, there's the House of Lords and so on, but all the real legislatures in the world, the important ones, are based on democratic representation, proportional representation of the people who are so governed. That's an American idea, and it is the basis of democracy everywhere in the world.
Jack, I know that we could talk easily for a couple of hours on all the information and the insight that you have put into this big, beautiful book. It was a privilege to read it, and it sure was heavy to lug around, but it was worth it because it is just terrific. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about that I neglected to ask?
I want Americans to be proud. To be proud of our nation. And at this time in our history, we seem to be uncertain about our national identity. Our history is something to be extraordinarily pleased with. We have many things to fix. We have lots of problems. We always have. But our system has embedded in it a process of continuous improvement and reform. And that's something that we should all embrace. Our revolution is not the source of oppression or injustice in American life. It's the source of our freedom, which is why I call the book what I did.
Jack D. Warren, Jr., our guest today on the bookshelf, his new book, Freedom, The Enduring Importance of the American Revolution. It's from Lions Press and available at bookstores and online. If you have not read much about the revolution, you need to, and this is the book that will fill in so many gaps and explain so many things for you. If you are an amateur student of history, as I am, and a lot of my friends are, you'll be delighted that there are lots of new things that you'll learn and new insights that you'll gain by reading it. So this is a great time to read this book. It actually came out last July, which is a perfect time for a book about the revolution to come out near to the 4th of July. But it's a great book to read any time of the year, and I hope people will do that. Thank you so very much. It's been a great pleasure, and I look forward to our next time together.
Well, I look forward to it, too. Thank you for having me. This has been lots of fun.
It's been our great pleasure today to talk to Jack D. Warren, Jr., the author of Freedom, The Enduring Importance of the American Revolution, from Lions Press. Thanks so much for joining us on the bookshelf today. And also check out my podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. We have over 500 interviews through the years that are loaded up there, so you can hear this interview and lots of others. Thank you for visiting on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next week, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.